We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge and we are glad to have you with us. President Obama has said that the key to the success of the internet has been its openness, and that is something that he says he wants to preserve. To that end, he proposed that the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, adopt rules that would prohibit broadband providers from discriminating against particular internet content or applications. However, all of that was thrown into question just last month when a federal court ruled that the FCC didn't have the authority to regulate broadband providers. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll try to look at the debate over net neutrality and ask who, if anyone, has authority over the internet. And our guest for the program is Marvin Amori. He is Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he teaches courses in domestic and international telecommunications law and cyber law. His commentary has been featured in a number of places, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Boston Globe, and others. Before coming to Nebraska, he practiced as an advocate in Washington, D.C., where he was involved in many of the big policy debates surrounding media and internet, including net neutrality, but also broadcast ownership limits, children's media rules, wireless policy, and access for everybody to high-speed internet. He served as general counsel for Free Press and also as a staff attorney at Georgetown University Law Center's Institute for Public Representation. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. We hope people be brief in their comments, but questions are welcome. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, the number to call, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it's long distance, use that number, 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions, comments to will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. At any point here, questions, comments certainly are welcome. And Professor Amori, hello.
Hello.
Thanks.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Good. Well, we appreciate it. The place to start, I think, is to talk a little bit about the issue that seems to me really to be at the heart of all this. And it's a term I'm sure people have heard often, but may not exactly be sure what it means. And what I'm thinking about here is net neutrality. What is net neutrality?
So net neutrality is a rule meant to preserve the way the internet has always worked. And historically, people, when they go on the internet, can use any website they want, use any technology they want, and they don't need permission from their phone company or their cable company to use any application or to post on a blog. It's essentially just an open network. And back in about really 2005, 2006, and since, the phone and cable companies, which generally dominate the market in providing internet access, have been saying, we want to assert more control over the internet. We want to determine which websites can go faster, which can go slower, block some websites that might compete with our partners, and essentially turn the internet more into cable TV or one big app store.
Yeah.
And the people who oppose that vision of the internet think that it's bad both for democracy and for economic innovation.
And I think that it's interesting that this is, I suppose, the result of a trend, something that's happened that maybe wasn't anticipated, at least in this sense. It seems that when the internet started to become widely available, people who looked at these issues and people at the FCC, they weren't really concerned because the assumption was that there would be lots of internet service providers and the providers would be separate from the carriers. Well, the fact of the matter is now the carriers essentially are the providers. And on top of that, there just aren't that many. Apparently, something like 97% of Americans either get their internet from a cable company or a phone company. So the way where we are now here is certainly not where we expected we would be.
That's absolutely true. And the market developed that way partly because of government decisions. there were, you know, there were decisions in the 2003 to 2007 time period that essentially deregulated access to the internet. Mm-hmm. Before that, for if you were using DSL or if you remember dial-up, you'd have your choice of ISP. You could choose AOL, Earthlink, Juno, and if one of them blocked websites or tried to impose these kinds of restrictions, you could simply cancel and dial up another. That sort of access for independent ISPs no longer exists. The law was changed in favor of the phone and cable industry, and now most people are stuck with the ISP provided by their phone company or their cable company. And in fact, it was just a few months after that regulatory decision in 2005 that the phone and cable companies started saying, now we're going to start imposing restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to be clear, the kinds of things that you're talking about, either having a carrier block a website or make it somehow privilege one website over another, or make it easier to go to one place or another, or maybe something like if you just did a general sort of web search, do something that would influence who comes up at the top and who comes up at the bottom, those sorts of things, are in fact these big carriers doing that?
Well, so what the big carriers have done so far, if you look at the big violations that have happened, there was a small phone company in Wisconsin back in 2005 was blocking Vonage, because Vonage is an online phone company that competed with this phone company. The next big sort of violation was when Comcast was secretly interfering with and actually blocking peer-to-peer transmissions, including BitTorrent, which are actually used for a lot of legal, not just illegal, transmissions of files for watching TV online. ABC.com was using it. NASA used it for big images. And it's a popular technology. And Comcast, which is one of the largest ISPs, internet service providers in the country, was blocking a super popular technology. So this is a real major net neutrality violation. And this is the one that the FCC issued the order against in 2008 that was struck down this year in April that you mentioned earlier. That big court case involved Comcast interfering with really popular technologies across their network. We've also had a cable company called RCN engaging in that kind of behavior. Cox was engaging in that kind of behavior. And a lot of companies had cut deals with this kind of shady spyware company called NebuAd. And what they were doing was they were monitoring all of the traffic on your link and then selling that information to advertisers. And occasionally you'll get examples of ISPs kind of hijacking your searches. So that you end up on their search engine, not on your preferred default search engine, and those are sort of the technical circumstances are kind of complicated. But you have a lot of these examples where the phone and cable industry is trying to meddle with where you can go online, which really affects the kinds of technologies that'll get invested in and created, and how you can use the internet.
Just very quickly, our guest this morning in this hour of focus is Marvin Amori. He is assistant professor of law at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and does a lot of writing in the areas of domestic and international telecommunications law. And this particular subject we're talking about here, that is internet policy, including things like net neutrality and access to broadband, things that he's done a lot of writing and speaking about. And that's what we're talking about.
And I should also, if you don't mind, explain for the readers or for the listeners. My point is usually as an advocate, I was actually the person who wrote the complaint against Comcast. I'm the lawyer who argued the case that you mentioned that went against us in April, arguing that the FCC had jurisdiction and had to enforce net neutrality. So my standpoint is as an advocate as well.
Well, I want to come back to that in a moment and talk a little bit more about that, about Comcast v. FCC. But sure. Just to step back a moment here and talk about what the Obama administration has said about internet access and how they think that this should operate. And then what is it that the White House thinks that the FCC should be doing?
Okay, great. So the Obama administration has been very strongly pro-net neutrality in their speeches and their rhetoric. The Obama campaign back in 2007 during the primary with Hillary Clinton issued a very aggressive technology innovation agenda that's actually very pro-public interest, very pro-consumer, pro-citizen. And at the top of the agenda was Barack Obama will preserve net neutrality. And he said during the campaign he would only appoint commissioners to the FCC that supported net neutrality. And since being president, he has repeatedly reaffirmed his support for net neutrality repeatedly. And just recently on an online interview, he said, I'm a big supporter of net neutrality. I campaigned on it. We're going to follow through. And his chairman of the FCC is a guy named Julius Genachowski, who apparently wrote his tech innovation agenda, also a big net neutrality supporter. So the Obama administration is a big fans of net neutrality. They're getting a lot of pressure from the phone and cable industry to not do net neutrality because the phone and cable industry is so powerful in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And so in light of the Comcast decision, what happened is the court there said the FCC doesn't have the authority under the current framework that they have adopted to engage in regulations of broadband carriers. And so the FCC said, okay, we'll change our framework to the framework that should have always applied that was changed a few years ago by the Bush administration. We'll go back to the old framework that was always there before deregulation, and I can explain that. And that's the big fight right now. Does the FCC go back to the old framework, therefore they can regulate broadband providers in, you know, to ensure internet for all and an open internet, or does the FCC walk away from the field and decide they're just not going to regulate the most important communications infrastructure of the 21st century? Mm. And the Obama FCC is moving towards asserting jurisdiction to protect consumers.
So the we had this particular problem with Comcast blocking this very popular application. The FCC comes along and says to Comcast, no, you can't do that. Comcast turns around, goes to court, and essentially what the people, the lawyers, the people who are working for Comcast were arguing was that the FCC, under present rules, doesn't have authority over us. The FCC has authority over what's called communications services, and I guess that means something like telephone, for example. But they said, but the rules say that information services, which the court said, well, that's what broadband is, under the Telecommunications Act of 1996, they say, well, the FCC doesn't have authority there. So have I got that pretty much right?
That's about exactly right. The key point is that it was the FCC under the Bush administration at sort of the height of deregulation that looked at internet access and said, you know, for a long time we had determined that providing access to the internet, providing connectivity to the internet, was a telecommunications service under the Act. Mm-hmm. And we determined that things like AOL, Earthlink, NewYorkTimes.com, Twitter, those were information services, and they're in a competitive market, and those are information services. We don't regulate those. And then, you know, sort of during the height of the deregulation, when we were deregulating banks and mortgage-backed securities and, you know, offshore drilling and everything else, the idea was, let's deregulate broadband carriers too. We'll define access to the internet, providing connectivity, as though it's just like Twitter, as though it's just like email, and we'll remove all of the obligations that applied in the Communications Act that were put there by Congress. We'll remove them all the same way they don't apply to Twitter. Mm-hmm. And then, so we were in a state where it was totally unclear what regulation could apply to the carriers. They were going to be treated like Twitter and email. So when the FCC said, we can stop Comcast from doing what they're doing, interfering with people's connections, blocking traffic online, the court, the D.C. Circuit, looked at the FCC and said, wait a minute, so you're telling us you can impose obligations based on some authority over information services. What, can you regulate Twitter? Can you regulate email? Can you regulate Facebook? And the FCC didn't really have a good answer. And the court essentially struck that down, and the point for the FCC is, they're going to have to go back to a rational framework where they define connectivity to the internet as a telecommunications service in their usual jurisdiction, and this way they won't be able to mess with Facebook or Twitter or anything else once they go through that, what they call reclassification, mm-hmm. and classify internet connectivity properly.
Now, although it seems that from what I've read, the current chairman is not inclined to do that, it certainly would be bound to generate lots of complaints. And I think that some people have actually argued that the FCC doesn't have the authority to do that kind of reclassification.
That's right. So not exactly. Right. The phone and cable industry made a real all-out press against the chairman of the FCC. And they were going to the White House every day. You know, CEOs were calling the White House, trying to get people to intervene. They're putting pressure in Congress. They're circulating a letter right now with a whole bunch of conservative Democrats who are signing on to this letter that disagrees with both the chairman of the FCC and the president on his stance. And so there's a lot of pressure coming from the phone and cable industry, and there was a point where it looked like, according to the Washington Post, the chairman of the FCC was not going to reclassify broadband and was going to sort of, you know, put his head down and try to figure out a new strategy. Mm-hmm. And the entire, you know, Netroots community, a lot of Democrats, there was just an explosion. MoveOn.org went to their 5 million activists with a direct number to the White House to call. Credo went out to their activists to call the FCC. The phones were ringing off the hook. There were blog posts all over. And after a week of just intense pressure, people saying, you know, Barack Obama, this was your central agenda for the Internet. You know, and Obama had used the Internet to win the primary. I mean, people understand the Democratic potential. After that week, the chairman said, you know, we're going to do reclassification. And so at the moment, the chairman has said he's going to move forward with reclassification. He's going to put the Internet connectivity back under the Communications Act where it should have always been, but he's going to remove a few of the rules that are sort of antiquated and unneeded. Mm-hmm. That's where the chairman is right now.
All right.
And he's still getting a lot of political pressure from the carriers, and then the public is you know, supporting him against that.
We have a caller, and others would be welcome. Here we take the first one. This is someone who's listening in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello. Yes.
I wanted to get some clarification because I've heard a number of things and it's not clear to me. One of the things I heard, and you could explain this to me and I might be misstating it, is that there are changes to be made which would require that when you go to certain websites, you all, whatever, whether it's left, right, or center, you would also be required to have links to other websites which are of differing other political persuasions. Now, I don't understand if that has anything to do with what you said, if there's any truth to that, or whether that's just a rumor. The other question I have is, to the extent that net neutrality means that anyone can buy internet service and have access to the net completely, to what extent is that going to be just a matter of a mandate or a matter of some sort of subsidies and consequences if it's not available? So I hope those questions are clear, and I'll get off and listen to you on the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
And if we, and please, you know, feel free to, if we don't get to them or you want to follow up, you certainly are welcome to do that.
Okay, I'll just stay on then.
Well, okay. Well, Professor Amori, can you answer those questions?
Yes. I'm so glad he asked both of those questions. So the first point as to whether or not websites will be required to link to opposing views, that's a total rumor, totally untrue. Has nothing to do with net neutrality. Net neutrality is simply to make sure the phone and cable industry doesn't interfere with the way the Internet has historically always worked. And what you see is a sort of disinformation campaign launched and funded by AT&T mainly and some other carriers, and they're funding this group called Americans for Prosperity, and they're going on Glenn Beck, and they're running ads, and they're calling it an Internet takeover. None of that is true at all. It's simply to preserve the way the Internet has always been. And if you go to savetheinternet.com, you know, you'll see hundreds of organizations on both sides, MoveOn.org, the Christian Coalition, lots of churches and civil liberties groups, and also tech companies and another coalition that are all in favor of net neutrality. None of them want interference with content and to be forced to link to competing views. The rumor actually started from a book called Republic.com that just sort of threw out the idea years ago. And even that author who threw out the idea has backed away from it and said it's a terrible idea, and no one's advocating for it. So I'm glad you asked that question. The second question about, which is slightly different from net neutrality, I think, is not the question of how do we make sure the Internet remains open and free, but how do we get the Internet to everyone in the country, right? So, I mean, today the internet is just our basic infrastructure for so many things we do. We book tickets online. We do our banking online. We learn about the news, keep in touch with our friends, and see, you know, pictures of our friends' vacations online. And you find jobs online. And you're on eBay and have your own small business online. It's just basic infrastructure. And people who don't have access to the internet are sort of left out of our society, both, you know, in terms of democratic participation and economic. And how do we get connections to everyone? So the FCC adopted recommendations in a national broadband plan, and their plan is to try to get essentially to subsidize build out to communities where it's not profitable to build out in the private sector. So rural areas, you know, places like western Nebraska, near where I teach, you'd have subsidies to try to get connections out to those people. And then you also could do digital learning centers. There are lots of things that the FCC can and should do, and they need the authority to do so.
Thank you.
All right. And I suppose that I'm sure that there are some people who make the argument, though, that that carriers, if they have this ability to privilege some sites over others, and that they want to be able to make the most sort of popular stuff the most accessible, the quickest, and if they have some way to profit from that, then they will be profitable business, and that also will make it more likely that they will be able to offer more widely the service at a lower price. I mean, that's the argument that's marshaled for being able to, the carrier have this kind of ability to do some discriminating amongst content providers or different methods of distributing content.
Yeah, exactly. So the carriers make that argument, and on its face, it's kind of a plausible argument that if they can charge, say, Google lots of money to be on the internet and other websites, then they could then they'd have more money, and if they have more money, they could charge consumers less, and they could build out to new communities, and consumers would have lower prices. The problem with their argument, and the organization Free Press issued a whole report on investment and net neutrality by Derek Turner. So the problem with the argument, in short, is there's nothing saying the phone and cable companies will actually pass on those savings to consumers rather than pass on those profits to their shareholders. And if the phone and cable companies were in a competitive market, if it were very highly competitive, a lot of those savings would have to be passed on to consumers. But if they're not a competitive market, two companies, as you say, dominate the market, the phone company and the cable company. So once they raise prices on the application side and sort of reduce innovation, make it harder for people to be heard online, they can just take that money and put it in their pocket.
We are at our midpoint of this hour, and I'd like to introduce again our guest, Marvin Amori. He is Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he teaches both domestic and international telecommunications law and cyber law. His commentary on this issue and others has been featured in a lot of places, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Boston Globe, Philadelphia Inquirer, Newsweek, other places. Before coming to Nebraska, he practiced as an advocate in Washington, D.C., where he was involved in a lot of these kinds of policy debates involving media and internet, including net neutrality, but also things like broadcast ownership limits and rules on children's media and the whole question of access to high-speed internet. He served as general counsel for Free Press and as a staff attorney at Georgetown University Law Center's Institute for Public Representation. And as he explained early in the program, in fact, he was involved in this particular case that we've talked about, the Comcast versus the FCC case that threw into question the FCC's ability to regulate the broadband. And he was involved in this case on the FCC pro-regulation net neutrality kind of side. Questions are welcome. And I hope I'm accurately representing your involvement there?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Also, you may email your questions and comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. As I mentioned, you work in the area of both telecommunications law here in the United States and also internationally. So if you look at other countries, say European countries, How is it that they approach the issue of net neutrality?
So in European countries, the issue of net neutrality is becoming a bigger question. It's being debated more often. And I was recently in Germany talking about net neutrality and doing interviews about net neutrality because the debate's kind of heating up. They've been watching what we've been doing in the U.S. And in Europe, they have a different system in terms of competition among Internet service providers. Unlike the U.S., which almost alone decided to let phone and cable companies dominate the ISP market, in the U.S., in the European market, you can still get essentially what we used to think of as dial-up. You could get competing ISPs. And the way it works is, let's say your traditional ISP is France Telecom, but there's a new company that comes along called Iliad. Iliad can have access to some of France Telecom's network and then put in their own new, fancy, brand-new technologies and then offer you faster service than France Telecom at a cheaper price. And then there's competition among ISPs over the same lines that had always been there, that had been under, you know, monopoly regulation and guaranteed returns historically for the monopoly. And now there's new competition. And what we've seen in the rest of the world is they thought, we don't need to worry too much about net neutrality because we still have competition among ISPs. It's turning out that they still need to worry a little bit about net neutrality, and they're trying to develop a framework. But what they have in terms of broadband around the world is they often have faster connections that are far cheaper. So if you look at Japan, which has been very successful in this kind of model of ISPs competing, you can get, you know, 100 megabit connection up and down. And even if you don't know what a megabit is, you know what 100 is, right? And here in this country, usually you'll get, you know, 3, 5, 8 megabits, and for about 4 times the price per megabit. And so, you know, if you look at all of the rankings in terms of the world, we're like 15th or 16th in penetration and adoption in speed and price. And we're falling behind the rest of the world in this basic infrastructure that's core to every business we care about. And so the net neutrality problem is emerging out there, but a lot of the problems we have here, really high prices and low speeds, aren't emerging there as much.
We have another caller. Let's talk with them. This is someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm curious. The judge that handed down the decision on the regulation, was that one of Bush's appointees?
No. The decision was unanimous, actually. There were two Republican appointees who were very conservative, actually. One's very conservative. And then one was a Clinton appointee who's pretty liberal. And both, and the, you know, the way the argument felt to me was the Republicans were, you know, kind of curious as to why the FCC was kind of going on a jaunt outside of its traditional jurisdiction, whereas the liberal Democrat seemed very concerned that he asked a lot of questions about, can you regulate Twitter? Can you regulate Facebook? Can you regulate, you know, how far can you go in this newfangled kind of jurisdiction you're asserting? So across the board, they all were concerned that the FCC could, under the jurisdiction they're trying to assert, go too far. And the FCC would correct that, I think, by reclassifying and separating out the connectivity from the actual applications on top.
So the decision really wasn't net neutrality, but peripheral.
That's true. It was on the FCC's jurisdiction to impose rules on broadband connectivity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. So,
sure,
again, just to, not to put too fine a point on this, but so the issue really in this case was technical in the sense that what they were just saying, the court just said, look, here are the rules, and the rules say this, and what you want to do is outside the rules as they exist right now. So it was sort of a technical issue and not so much about whether the FCC should or should not have that kind of authority.
Yeah, exactly. So before the FCC, the decision and the question was whether or not it was the right policy and for the government to adopt net neutrality and to stop Comcast from what it was doing. And agencies like the FCC are usually allowed to adopt policy. They're part of the policy-making political apparatus. And then the court doesn't really review the policy so much as whether or not the FCC had the jurisdiction to adopt that policy. And jurisdiction for an independent agency comes from a statute. And here the statute is the Communications Act. And what had happened under the Bush administration, just to sort of get the technical details out, because your callers actually want to know, is the FCC Communications Act has several titles that regulate different things.
Right.
Title 2 for communications in two-way networks. Title 3 for broadcast TV. Title 6 for cable TV. And what the FCC said is broadband connectivity is not in any of these titles. But we still have this residual authority to regulate it, sort of in a residual way. And the court just said, and the court didn't really buy the FCC's theory that had no outer limit and seemed to go beyond what Congress had authorized. And they thought it could be dangerous to sort of give them this, to uphold this first order. And so if the FCC goes back to the previous framework, where they separate out connectivity, apply the rules of in Title II of the Act that apply to two-way networks, then the FCC is cabined. They can only apply those Title II rules, and they can't also try to meddle with Twitter or your emails.
And again, just to go back to this earlier question that I had about some people saying that this reclassification that we're talking about, and that is to say to take broadband and to put it into one of these titles that clearly they do have authority on, that there were some people who apparently said, oh, FCC, you can't do that. Well, in fact, can they do that?
Great question. And so the phone and cable industry hired a guy named Seth Waxman, who's a former solicitor general under Clinton, the top lawyer for the government, with the job Elena Kagan now has. And he wrote up 10 pages saying the FCC can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the two questions turn on, one, can the FCC interpret its own statute in a way that the court will defer to their reading of it? And so the FCC's got to say, we were wrong in how we read the statute, and now we're going to read it differently. Or they could say there are new factual circumstances, and the factual scenario we came up with before was inaccurate. And I think it's a very strong case that the FCC could reclassify. The Supreme Court itself decided the question of whether or not the FCC could classify broadband connectivity as an information service like Twitter. That was back in 2005. And that was a case called Brand X. And there were three dissenters. The majority said, we're not sure this is the best reading of the statute. There are two ways to read the statute. Broadband connectivity could be a telecommunications service under Title II, or it could be an information service outside of the Act. And the FCC has discretion to interpret its own statute if it's reasonable, and both of these readings are reasonable. The dissent of three justices led by Justice Scalia said this is a completely unreasonable reading to read broadband connectivity as outside of the Act. The only reasonable way to read this statute is the way the lower court had read it and the way that these three justices were reading it and the way the Democratic dissents had read it, which is broadband connectivity service is a Title II communication service under the Act. So considering six justices said there are two ways to read the Act that are reasonable, this one's reasonable, and three of them said the only reasonable way to read it is Title II, I think you've essentially got all nine of them who'd agree that it's reasonable to interpret the Act as Title II.
Yeah, it certainly seems to me that particularly now where we are with telecommunications and broadband and the way that people use all of these things and what they're using them for and the increasing convergence of all these technologies seems to me to make it much harder. In fact, I don't even know how you really make the argument that says, well, broadband is, well, it's kind of something different. It's as if it's on some sort of different continent from telecommunications. And I don't see how you make an argument like that.
I think it was very convoluted the first time they did it. I know Justice Scalia's dissent is biting and kind of funny. Essentially, he says, imagine you call up a pizzeria and say, do you deliver pizza? And he goes through his whole analogy about how the FCC's definitions would make you think the pizza guy was crazy if he answered the questions the way the FCC answered them. I think it's fairly convoluted. And it just doesn't seem right that Congress would not want the FCC to have jurisdiction over the most important technology that people use for communications. I mean, they're the Federal Communications Commission. And I don't think they should be the the agency in charge of only landline phone service and cable TV.
Well, it seems that if you take a look at how the sides line up here, that on the one hand, this kind of version of net neutrality and the authority of the FCC to regulate, if you say, well, who thinks that this is good? Well, generally, you got big content providers, Google, Amazon. You have, generally speaking, Democrats in Congress, although there are conservative Democrats that are opposed and line up with basically with the Republicans and with the major carriers, guys like people like AT&T and Verizon and Comcast. If you look at how all this lines up in Congress, is it likely that Congress would actually get involved and indicate some direction here?
You know, it's actually pretty unlikely. In terms of, you know, Congress is fairly broken at the moment, having trouble passing routine things. There's gridlock on everything. And the phone and cable industry are really, really powerful in D.C. Like, when you talk about the power of special interests, you know, the phone companies were local monopolies for a long time, and their business wasn't to compete. It was to convince regulators to give them things. And the cable companies, they were also monopolists for a long time, and their business plan was to convince regulators to give them things. And both of them have just armies of lobbyists, very close connections to a congressman. And so despite the fact that the president himself and the FCC chairman and the heads of the committees that regulate broadband, all of these people are strongly pro-net neutrality, strongly in favor of ensuring access for all. It's still, you'll get these rogue Democrats. You'll get a lot of pushback from the Republicans. And I think the Republicans at this point are opposing just about anything the Democrats will try. And usually telecom issues historically had not been so partisan. Mm-hmm. They've become more and more partisan recently.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Marvin Amori, he is Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and teaches in the areas of both domestic and international telecommunications law. And some of the things we've been talking about here this morning, net neutrality and access to high-speed internet, is some of the things that he's always been concerned about and written about and talks about and has also advocated about. Our guest this morning is joining us by phone, and you can too. If you want to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, I think that the general argument for deregulation of any industry always runs something like this. Well, if you deregulate, if you open it up, then that means that more and more people will be attracted to that business and offering that kind of service. And if you get more people into offering the service, then that means it will be more widely available, more people will be able to access it. And if we have more people out there providing the service more widely, then there's going to be competition, and then the cost of the service will go down. That's sort of the standard deregulation argument. Why is it that deregulation has not worked that way for internet?
Yeah, so the story you just told is the story the FCC told in 2002 when they deregulated. That was the exact story. They said, if we deregulate cable and phone, then they'll make huge profits, and other companies will see those profits and decide they want to enter, and then we'll have lots of competition among competing platforms. There'll be satellite competing with phone and cable. You'll have wireless. You'll have broadband over power line. You can, you know, plug in to an electrical outlet and get internet connectivity. And none of that really panned out. What happened on the satellite side is, just in terms of the costs and the technology, those are really slow connections and really expensive. No, very few people will take satellite connections over phone and cable connections because of the cost and the speed. Broadband over power line, even though the chairman at the time said it was, you know, quote, ready for prime time, it's not ready for prime time, and there are very few people who have broadband over power line. And then on the wireless side, AT&T and Verizon have most of the valuable, like, channels to provide broadband access, and most of the new additions are essentially the two largest internet providers wirelessly, and they have their own landline services that they don't want to compete with too aggressively. They want people to get internet at home through DSL and then get internet on their phone as well. And the new Clearwire service is a deal with cable. So a lot of these new technologies either don't work or are owned by the same phone and cable companies that are in the market. And the real thing is it's just the cost structure is such that no, in terms of all these infrastructure businesses, nobody can build out, you know, a whole new network in a competitive environment. If you look at how cable and phone and even the electricity grid, but cable and phone I know best, how they were built out, they were both built out with monopoly, guaranteed monopolies, guaranteed returns, and guaranteed no competition. So the phone company would, you know, would every year spend $1 billion in investments, and they would ask the government to be able to charge $1.1 billion and make a decent return, and then they just built out their network without competition with a guaranteed return. And no one can come along now and compete with those established giants and build out a whole network and do it from scratch, which is why the European companies require access to the existing networks and let people just build parts of the network that are less expensive and technologies so they can compete.
Mm. And I think that some people, I suppose, would make the argument that the way to deal with this problem is to get away from the wires, and that's the advantage that having some kind of wireless access is going to give you, because then you don't have to, the kind of infrastructure that you have to have, you don't have to go out there and lay fiber optic cable. Is that really, though, not possible because, again, we sort of go back to the dominance of the existing systems by the existing major carriers?
Yeah, so let me make 2 points there. I'm glad you asked that question. First point is the FCC is hinting at, it's not quite clear, they're sort of leaving the door open, of exempting wireless broadband from their reclassification. It's very unclear, but that would be devastating. That would be a terrible, huge loophole to the benefit of AT&T and Verizon, because most people get their internet, or a lot of people get their internet, in addition to at home, on their phones, on their smart cards. And increasingly, people will be subscribing to 4G and 3G networks for their computer. And so if the FCC exempts wireless, that would be a disaster. But two, then it would not be a solution. But even if they properly apply reclassification to both wired and wireless and how people actually get the internet, then you still have the problem of technology and cost. So if you're on a wireless phone, like if I'm on my Android phone, which is the Verizon Google phone, if I'm on this phone and I make a phone call or I check the internet, what happens is I connect to a local antenna, and then that local antenna goes underground and goes to these wires, and these wires go across the country, and then it pops up over an antenna and goes somewhere else and completes the call to someone else's cell phone. But it's part wired, part wireless, and in terms of costs, you need access to licenses to do that, and those cost billions of dollars at auction, and there are very few licenses that are going to be available because most of the licenses have been allocated. So one, you can't get the licenses. Two, you need access to those backhaul lines, which are mainly controlled by AT&T and Verizon, who charge incredibly high prices for their competitors like Sprint and T-Mobile, making it very hard for them to compete.
Going back to the bigger question of broadband access here in this country for a moment, and you talked earlier about the fact that, for example, in other countries there are more choice in terms of providers and people have faster service and they pay less. Well, here in the United States, there are places where you can't get access. Or we come down to the point, as I mentioned, that something like almost all of Americans, 97% of Americans, either get their internet from a cable company or a phone company. So they're dealing with a handful of very big providers. Now, the administration has said, well, they think that affordable access to broadband for everybody is a priority, and that they're also very committed to this net neutrality idea. Well, you know, given where we are now, again, with the setup that we have, what do you think, or the administration think, or anybody thinks realistically can be done to change things so that there can be greater access for as many people as possible in an affordable way?
So, let me give you a few thoughts. So the first thought is the FCC asked the Harvard Berkman Center, which is their center for society at Harvard, to do a report on what's worked around the world, sort of literature review. And the author of that report is a guy named Yochai Benkler, a very esteemed Harvard professor. And he wrote a 300-page report analyzing all the data around the world, definitive great report, Yochai Benkler, Berkman Center, FCC report. And his conclusion was, we need competition among ISPs similar to what they have in Europe and Japan, where anyone can choose their own ISP over the existing lines, and so it's not just the option of the phone company's ISP or the cable companies. The FCC wasn't quite convinced, and they thought it would just be far too politically difficult because of how powerful the phone and cable industry are. And so as a result, that was sort of taken off the table for political reasons. And then in terms of what could be done, is we have to assume under any FCC, I guess, that there's going to be a phone company and a cable company without competition, and that's all you're getting. And then how do we get them to serve everyone and to increase their speeds? So one, you have the issue of subsidizing service in rural areas, the government putting in money to do so. That's one thing, the government essentially funding it. Two, try to get more spectrum on the market. That could be helpful. And the big proposal, the controversial proposal in the National Broadband Plan, was to take a lot of the spectrum that TV broadcasters have, right? Because anything wireless uses channels, and you can use a lot of those channels for something else. So the TV broadcasters are using their channels to broadcast TV, and the idea is, why don't we take a lot of that back and auction it off and get that used for wireless internet instead? So that's the second option. Subsidies and getting some more wireless out there are really what the FCC is hoping for. What you can expect is that the cable companies, they can upgrade their lines far more cheaply than the phone companies. So someone like AT&T or Verizon, they're using these old copper lines that were used for phone service. They don't provide that much throughput for broadband, whereas the cable companies, they can transition a lot of their existing cables away from providing TV and towards providing internet. They just sort of change the division. Right now, 90% of their pipe provides TV and like 10% provides internet. They can increase how many of those channels they provide internet over. And if they do that, it's fairly cheap for them. They can provide higher speeds. And what you might have across the country is really just one dominant high-speed provider, the cable company, and then the phone companies falling behind everywhere except for in places where the phone companies have built out fiber, which is a few places in the East Coast by Verizon.
So even I recognize this is a little bit different question, but I guess I'm thinking about how we have seen a very rapid increase in people's accessing various kinds of media and information this way, essentially by using a computer or a smartphone or something like that. So there's this huge demand to be able to acquire vast amounts of information, really, and big complicated stuff. So people are gone just beyond web surfing. They're downloading movies and television shows and all kinds of things that places a great demand, great burden on the network as it exists. Is it, say we do move to the point where we have a few big cable providers being as dominant as the phone company used to be back in the day before it was broken up. Does the system that exists or the ability to add to that system, is it up to the task of meeting, can it be up to the task of meeting the demand?
Yeah, so that's actually an excellent question. And I've talked to a lot of engineers about this. So just all the way up both sides. You know, one argument is, that the phone and cable industries can't keep up with all the capacity demands that are coming forward, and they need to be able to ration that bandwidth by charging people for slots and priority. The counter argument, which I'll make in greater detail, is one: congestion has always been a part of the internet, and traditionally the most cost-effective way to deal with congestion and capacity problems was simply to invest in more capacity. Just make the freeways bigger instead of giving some cars priority. And that's been the historical way to do it. And if you look at other technology markets, you know, think about your computer. Every 18 months, a new computer comes out, and it's half as expensive or twice as fast. You know, in technology markets, you could expect your phones. You expect these things to keep up with capacity and demand, and they have historically. What you lack in the phone and cable market is competition requiring them to do that. Right? They want to avoid capital expenditures. They want to avoid putting in and reinvesting in their network. What they want to do is just, you know, charge you $100 a month and then kick that money back to their investors without having to upgrade. And the cheapest way they could do that, they think, is to sort of, you know, reduce demand by blocking certain popular applications and sort of keeping people at a point where they're not increasing what they're doing on the internet.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us around to the very place that we started.
Yeah.
And that, which is really what this whole argument is about, whether or not they should be able to do that.
Yep, exactly. And I think they should invest in capacity. And I think once you give them the ability to start charging for priority, that gives them every incentive to not invest in capacity, but to invest in scarcity. Right? If there are only, you know, 10 companies that will be able to go through the internet, you know, or 100, pick your number, that are able to go through the internet clear and in a user-friendly way, then everyone wants to bid on those few slots. They can auction off those slots and make a lot more money on scarcity without having to invest in capacity. And if they have to invest in capacity, or if they can't charge any of them, then they'll have to simply accommodate all the growth on the internet that we see year after year.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop because we're here come to the end of the time. I'm sorry we have a caller we can't take, and I'm sure we'll get back to these issues again on other days. But for the moment, we have to leave it there with our thanks to Marvin Amori. He is Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And Professor Amori, thank you very much.
Thank you so much as well.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2444.
We're going to take a break here, as we usually do when we come back. In hour number two, Celeste Quinn will be the host for the show, and she will be looking at summer as a time for recreation and play, as well as a time with opportunities for development and service. She'll have several guests here in the studio who work with children and are familiar with summer programs in the Champaign-Urbana area, and they'll be talking about what's going on in the area for kids, so we hope that you'll stick around. First, though, we'll break, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the markets and some news from NPR.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tom Testel and Morris at 815-941-2184. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right out to the pits where in Kansas City, July wheat is trading 487.5 down 4. December, 517.25 down 3.75. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade trading 463 down 6.25. December, 510 down 7. July corn, 357.75 down 0.5. September, 367 down 1. December, 376.5 down 1.5. May of 2011, 393.25 down 5.75. July soybeans, 942.5 up 4. August, 922.5 down 8. September, 905.25 down 7.25. November, 904 down 1.75. July soybean meal, 275 up 160. August, 269.